No, just some outlines. Thought it'd be an interesting twist to give you the test the first day of the semester. Yeah, right. Show you how much you need to learn. Okay, let's get the roll sheet here first. Even got Dale with us in person. You're going to be able to be here every day, or? Wonderful. Good. Yes.
For the last test, would you put them in the library?
Yeah, they should be in the library. Yeah, everything should be there. I didn't get them in until...
Yeah, this morning.
Okay. Now, I don't know how long they're going to leave them in the library before they... Whatever. So you probably want to check if you don't have it yet. Well, we got one more semester to go. We could easily keep going and going and going, but what we're going to do this semester basically is several major areas that we're going to be working with. First, we're going to start today with Dana and Manti and start going through first the case functions and, you know, some of the detailed information that we've been promising you in the past that we haven't gotten a chance to get to yet. So we're going to start doing that. And if you don't have a copy of Dana and Manti, why don't you grab one off the shelf there? Maybe some of you guys could take, how many of you need one to look at here if you didn't bring yours today? Okay, go ahead, and they'll distribute it for you. And what you may want to do when you bring your own is, as I go through, you may want to, we're not going to go through every word in the book. I'm going to hit the highlights and so forth. I could just lecture to you from notes, but I think it would be better for you to, you know, be hearing and looking, and we can talk and ask questions and so forth, because this is about as good as any book I know on the kinds of things that it's dealing with. And so we'll start with that today, but... Just to let you know what other things we're going to be doing. We're going to be looking at case functions today. Then we're going to be looking at the article also, and maybe some with prepositions. We'll see in this Dane and Manti. We're also going to be doing diagramming, and we'll be getting into that probably within a couple weeks. And then we're going to be continuing our translating of the New Testament, and we're not going to try to go all the way through the Gospel of John, because that would probably take us a whole semester just to do that. But I'm going to get we're going to start taking, you know, samplings out of John first, and then we're going to start moving into other portions of the New Testament, the Pauline epistles, the book of Hebrews, which is considered the most difficult of all in the Greek as far as the grammar is concerned and the language, and try to get some samplings of all the different kinds of scriptures that we're going to be dealing with, some epistles, some prophecy, you know, book of Revelation, and so forth, just to get an idea of how things flow. And also we'll be having, you know, about the only thing we're going to do with Getchus is in the last part of Getchus, you know, in that chart of principal parts, we're going to use that as kind of a vocabulary. I'll be giving you vocabulary quizzes on the principal parts during the course of the semester, so we'll cover those in sections. And I'll give you an announcement on that before too long. Roughly every 2 weeks or so, we'll have a vocab quiz on a section of that. So that's kind of what it looks like. Now, I mentioned to you last semester also that we're also going to be looking at a research paper on any topic that we've discussed already. Prepositions, I'm going to leave it a little bit open. In the past, I've done it just with prepositions, but I want you to start thinking about, if you haven't thought already, about what you would like to work on there, whether it be prepositions, whether it be the function, some of these case functions. Somebody could take some of those, maybe try to, a good project would be to take the dative case form with the instrumental and the locative and construct an argument, you know, for whether it's three separate cases or whether it's one case with various ramifications, or whether is there a difference between locative and instrumental, and something like that would be interesting. Aorist participle, somebody was interested in that. We might have some guys doing that for grad program too, and so forth. So be thinking about that, and probably by mid-semester you should have something on board and going. Otherwise, you'll never make it. And I'm not going to make this real long. I'll give you some stipulations and limitations and so forth before too long. Okay, so any questions about the kind of approach we're going to be taking this semester? And from day to day, I'll try to let you know. You probably want to bring with you your interlinear regularly, because sometimes we'll get through a portion of this, we'll have 10 minutes left over, and we'll go back to translating. So we want to keep that as a regular thing. Okay, Yes, go ahead. No, I didn't mean that. I mean your text. Okay, no interlinear. Thank you. Okay, if you'll turn in Dana and Manti, assuming these are all the same edition, so they've got the same page numbers. First of all, now if you want, I would recommend if you go ahead and read this introductory material. You know, when you get an opportunity, it doesn't even necessarily need to be during the semester here, but later on, just to get familiar with the book. But we're not going to go through a lot of this because most of this first section has been covered in our other book. And so he gets into the alphabet and breeding marks and all the rest. But if you'll turn to page 70, let's see here. Well, I guess it's 65, page 65. We're dealing with the noun and the cases. That's the first thing we want to go into in detail. Now, Dane and Manti argue for an eight-case system. Some books argue for five cases, four or five, depending whether you count vocative or not. And others argue for eight. So he's an advocate of an eight-case system. And, you know, you can get into lots of arguments and debates about this issue, which I think I've explained before isn't all that productive in my estimation. I mean, it's if you define it in terms of function, you're going to come up with eight. If you define it in terms of form, you come up with four. And that's essentially where the lines are drawn. And he defines it in terms of function. I think that the arguments about defining it for function, though, get a little fuzzier in some areas. And you'll see that as we go through. It's not always as easy, you know. There gets to be a certain amount of subjectiveness that's involved when you're dealing with it from the standpoint of function. Although, you know, there are some pretty clear distinctions in function, but sometimes the lines get fuzzy. That's where I think some of the problems are, and I think that the people who argue for four or five cases make that point. So I don't think we need to make a commitment one way or the other where we're going to be eight-case people or four-case people. I think what we need to do is understand what's happening, understand that we're dealing with various functions within those case systems, and actually we'll break it down into a lot more different subcategories. The genitive, for example, I don't know how many subcategories he's got listed here, and there's a lot of the other books, of course, do the same thing. He's got about eight of them, I guess, subcategories for the genitive. And so we'll get into it here and see what we're looking at. First of all, section 79 here, take this one with a large grain of salt, if not throw it out entirely. It gets into this evolutionary look at the origin of languages. And so he says, there were certainly at least eight cases in the primitive Indo-European tongue. Now this Indo-European tongue is a non-existent fiction of evolutionary mentality. It stems from the idea and the belief that these Indo-European languages evolved from some common ancestor. And I'll just refer you to Chris Erickson sometime. He's done a lot of study in linguistics and so forth in his background, and he can maybe give you some insight into the details of that. It's not to say that languages haven't changed and that things can't be, you know, similarities can't be seen and so forth. There's no question about that. But when you start postulating the existence of things that you really don't have any subjective or objective data for, you've got to put a big question mark around all of that. So his point, though, is he's trying to derive this eight-case system from this Indo-European tongue, as it were. And most of that information comes in the next section you'll see here. Let me just skip down to section 80. Says there are two reasons for concluding that we properly have eight cases in Greek. The first intimation of the fact was obtained from investigation of the Sanskrit, which exhibits eight case forms. So they're looking at Sanskrit having eight separate case forms and then inferring that there's a relationship between Greek. When the Greek cases were studied in the light of these eight Sanskrit cases, it was discovered that the same general distinctions prevailed. Now that kind of study is a little suspicious in my mind. You know, in other words, you study one language and you see some parallels to another language, and then I don't really trust sometimes, you know, when you're trying to set up your mind to look at things a certain way. Then sometimes you see things. It reminds me of the animalcules that they saw, you know, that Leeuwenhoek and others saw in the microscope when they first invented the microscope. They claimed that they saw little tiny donkeys in the semen of a donkey, you know, little tiny ones with little ears and everything, and they wrote this in the journals and so forth, because, you know, their concept of what, of how things work, you know, thought they worked, was projected into what they thought they saw. So I don't want to be too hard on them here, but I just want to, you know, put some healthy skepticism in your mind about some of these things, so that we at least try to keep it in the proper balance and not just swallow everything as if this is fact, because Sanskrit has eight cases. And I'm not really arguing against an 8-case system. I'm just a little bit leery of making too many comparisons, since languages are different. And if we believe that there's been changes in the languages and so forth, that type of thing, then it's odd that we are trying to force them back to be the same. But he says, this sound method of comparative philology has brought the 20th century Greek grammarian to recognize that there are 8 cases in Greek instead of 5. Well, at least some grammarians. All right?
I like the way you said that.
Yeah.
Modern.
Right. I know. Yeah, it's like this has been scientifically dated to 4.5 billion years, you know. Okay. Well, anyway, moving right along here, back into the real meat of the thing, and this is the thing we really want to get into, section 81. In addition to the process of comparative investigation, this conclusion is also based on the very obvious fact that case is a matter of function rather than of form. Now, this is where he's getting to a more solid argument basis. In other words, now we're looking at the data. Now we're looking at what we actually find. And I don't think I would argue at all with the statement that case is a matter of function rather than form. In other words, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we throw forms out. We don't worry about them. Obviously, forms are involved. But the concept of case is defined with reference to the function of the word within the sentence. How is it functioning within its sentence structure? That's what we're interested in when we talk about case. The case of the Greek noun is to be determined by its relation to the rest of the sentence. Every case as such stands in a necessary connection according to its nature with the structure of the sentence in which it occurs. We have seen above that the fundamental elements of a sentence are a noun and a verb. The simplest typical sentence, the noun is the subject, and therefore in the nominative case. It is absurd to think of turning the statement around and saying that the noun is in the nominative case and therefore the subject. Hence, it may be easily seen that function rather than form determines case and consequently the fundamental consideration. Now, of course, when we're learning Greek and we're trying to assign a function within a sentence, not knowing which word is which, we do in fact look for the nominative case and then we say that's the subject. But that's only because we know that the person, in the, you know, they're wording the thoughts and so forth, put the subject in their mind in the nominative case. So now we look for the nominative case and, you know, say that's the subject. But in other words, when he says it's absurd to think of turning the statement around, he means from the standpoint of the reasons why in the language things are in certain positions, not in terms of doing your own individual study and trying to find the, you know, we've already taught you to look for the thing in the nominative case to decide what's the subject and so forth. But that doesn't mean that it's the subject because it's in the nominative case. It's in the nominative case because it's the subject. In other words, the person who made the statement in their mind had a relationship of concepts in their mind that they were trying to express in words, and to express the fact that this was the subject in their mind, they put it in the nominative case. Okay, now section 82 is one I want to zero in on. This section 82 you may want to look at, and you see the chart on the top of the next page. That's one you may want to either memorize or, you know, it's not that difficult to memorize. Just the main thing I'm interested in is these root ideas that are expressed in the last column here. This chart is separating the first the forms, then the case, according to his 8-case system, and then the root idea of each of those cases. And we'll go through this in section 82 here and just describe each one of those. Now, we've already had some exposure to this, so this shouldn't be brand new, but the distinction between ablative and genitive and the locative and instrumental aspects of the dative are things we haven't really emphasized too much. So let's take a look at this. So section 82, then as we attempt to analyze the cases of the Greek noun, we must seek to discover the functions which it performed in the structure of the sentence. As a noun, it is commonly employed in Greek. As a noun is commonly employed in Greek, it exhibits the following uses. Number one, its primary and typical use is to designate the object of consciousness. In other words, it's specifying the thing that you're really talking about, the thing that's performing the action, sentence, and so forth, concerning which the assertion contained in the predicate is made. So it's the object of consciousness that the action of the predicate is concerning. That is, it's the function of subject. It's the subject of a sentence. This function we call the nominative case. So nominative is designation. If you see in the chart over here, root ID is designation. And of course, hence the name nominative, idea of nomos, you know, naming, so forth. Onoma, really, is what it comes from. Then secondly, a noun is sometimes used without specific grammatical relations, simply as the object of address, which use we call the vocative case. We've already looked at that to some extent in the last chapters of Getches. The address, and there's no necessary grammatical relations. You're just saying, oh, so-and-so, and then you go on with a sentence that's not grammatically related to the thing that you stated in the first place. Something in the vocative case is not going to be subject or object or anything else. It's just your consciousness has been drawn to this individual as one that you're talking to, and then you go ahead and talk. Okay, now there's going to be some other uses of nominative. They're somewhat similar to that as we see it broken down. Then thirdly, so you can see over here in your chart, the root idea of the vocative is address. Then thirdly, one noun may be used to define the character or relations of another, which function we describe as the genitive case. Defining character or relations. And we'll be spending quite a bit of time on the genitive. That's one that's one case that involves, it's really worthy of a lot of study and a lot of consideration. And we'll be paying attention to this as we're doing translating. There's lots of different kinds of ways in which things can be described as to their character or their relations. Since there's a lot of different relationships possible between nouns, between objects of consciousness, as it were, you're going to see a lot of subcategories of the genitive. And that also generates considerable ambiguity. I don't think there's a single case in Greek. Probably dative would be second, but genitive is first in terms of potential ambiguity. In other words, you see a phrase like the faith of Jesus Christ. If you don't think about it too much, it's not much of a problem. But if you start thinking about the faith of Jesus Christ, does that mean the faith that Jesus Christ possessed? Does that mean the faith in Jesus Christ? In other words, our faith, our having faith of him? Does it mean Jesus Christ kind of faith? A faith like Jesus Christ had? There's a lot of possibilities there. And it's interesting, though, one thing that's maybe a little helpful is that the kinds of ambiguities in the English construction are the same kinds of ambiguities you find in the Greek construction. They pretty much line up. So that may be some comfort. I don't know. Okay. But these things are well worthy of consideration, and I want to take some time as we're doing translating to think about some of those things once we start to see the various kinds of uses of genitives. Okay. Then fourthly, a genitive then is the case of definition. That's your basic idea involved. Now, these root ideas, Dana and Mante seem to be pretty good as far as designating what the basic root concept is. And most of the other books are going to give pretty similar definitions of these things. So this is, I think, fairly safe as far as committing these things to memory. Now, fourthly, a noun may be used to denote the point of departure in a thought or of removal or derivation for which the ablative case is used. Point of departure is the term that he's using here. In his chart over here, he refers to it as separation, the ablative involving separation. And we'll explore that some more. I think we'll have to look at some examples and get into a little bit more detail on that to clarify that. Many just considered a special case of the genitive. Since the genitive is talking about source or origin or definition and so forth, the idea of separation is just kind of an extension of that, looking at this thing as being separated from its source but having been derived from it somehow. And the ablative is seeming to place a little bit more emphasis upon the present state of separation rather than the initial state, but it's still connected with that concept. So that's one that's going to be interesting. We'll be looking at some examples of that. And I suppose the preposition apo, the idea of away, that's probably, when I think of ablative, I think of the preposition apo. That seems to be the kind of the gist of the idea that's involved. There's a separation that's involved. But, the idea of separation, you can't talk about separation without having a concept of togetherness, as it were. In other words, the fact that you're saying that they're separated is having a certain implication. When you say a man and a wife were separated, it wouldn't make any sense to say that had they never been together. And so I think that's why there's a connection with this concept of genitive. But we'll have to look into this a little bit more. And I'll just say that much now, and we'll get to the details later. But the root idea is separation. Fifthly, a noun may be used to indicate an object of interest or reference, which function we call the dative case. Interest or reference. And the term interest is used here in this chart. You might also put reference down there, too. I like that concept of reference. I think it might even be a little more general to help you. Because interest, usually think of interest in terms of people. And the data doesn't necessarily always have to refer to people. It can be objects and things and so forth. And so I think reference might be even a more generally accurate term. Okay. And that one's also one that opens itself up. There's lots of different kinds of things and ways in which things can be referring to something else. And so it opens us up to a lot of subcategories, which we'll explore later. Then, sixthly, a noun may be used to indicate the position of an object or action for which the locative case is used. Of course, locative, think of the term location. And it's the idea of location, position, that is seen primarily in this function of the dative. And, well, we'll get into this later, but the more I've studied this, the more it looks like that concept may be the overriding concept to the whole concept of dative. But I'll tell you more about that later and let you make some judgments. That's the kind of thing I'd like somebody to do some more study on. Okay, seventhly, sometimes a noun which denotes the means described in expression of thought. Such use we call the instrumental case. Means, something was done by means of something else. And that also has relationships to the concept of location and reference. So they're all put together here. And we'll look at examples of this. Preposition in is used a lot with a dative in this kind of a usage. And in is also, of course, one of the most obvious location, locative type of prepositions. Something in something is as locative as you can imagine, you know. But that's why there's a lot of debate between this difference between locative, instrumental, and so forth. And it gets you into some theological controversy sometimes. One person is going to call something instrumental, and he's going to interpret it a certain way. Another person is going to call it locative, and you get another interpretation out of it. So I think it's important that we be aware that there's no formal difference between these two. And if you read in a book someplace where the guy says it's obviously instrumental, that doesn't mean it's obviously instrumental. The form could be locative, dative, instrumental, and his judgment about it, based on his interpretation, is what caused the conclusion that he's come to. So that's something you all need to know, lest you commit yourself to something that may not necessarily be the case. Mm-hmm.
Romans 8, somewhere, praying, groaning.
Yes. There's a good example. In that instance, all you have no preposition. You have only a dative case form. And some are translating it with groanings because they're taking it instrumental. And if they were to analyze it, they would call it instrumental use of the dative. I wouldn't take it that way. Because of the context and other considerations, it violates the idea of reference. You might say with reference to groanings or for groanings, something like that, would be a better idea. And that's only because of context and other scripture trying to analyze that situation. But there may be another instance, where the same construction is used, and we may want to translate it with, because the form, covers quite a wide range, and we have to decide from context how to limit that range. And I think that's maybe a good bottom line that I want to, leave in your heart. Don't rely only upon some grammarian's analysis of it. Look at the context and parallel passages, and that is going to help you determine in these ambiguous cases exactly what's going on. And you see, the problem comes sometimes because a person's theology may determine how his context is set. And that's where the dangers come. Yes?
A good example of that is Colossians
1:16. That's a real good example.
Either locative or instrumental.
Right. It sure does. See, the Greek here says, in him were all things created. And King James translates it, by him were all things created. And they're taking it instrumental. One problem, though, that you run into when you do that is when you say, by him were all things created, in English, the phrase by can either be indirect agency or direct agency. In other words, we could say, he did this by him, or we could say, it was done by him, and make him the actual direct agent. In other words, our mode of expressing direct agency is to use by. Our mode of expressing indirect agency is also to use by sometimes, although we have some other ways to do it as well. And that generates another ambiguity. Now, one thing is clear. Even if you take this as instrumental in Greek, you have it indirect agency, not direct agency. Direct agency is quite consistently expressed by hupo plus the genitive in Greek. And but there's some debates that rage, you know, along those lines. And how would you decide an issue like that? How would you decide in Colossians 1:16 whether to take that as instrumental or as locative? And what I would say is it's ambiguous the way it stands, but you have parallel passages which already set a context. And if you look in Ephesians and find that same phrase, in him, and so forth, begin to look at it the way it's connected with other things, you begin to see a pattern emerge that helps you interpret this other passage. So that's something to keep in mind. And also, even if you take it instrumental, you need to have the right concept of what that instrumental is. It is not direct agency. It's not God the Father turning it over to God the Son. Even if you take it instrumentally, you can still see the same basic picture, that God is doing it in and through his Son in this plan of time and so forth. You'd still be, you know, on the right track. But, it's care must be exercised in places like that. And that's what we want to try to emphasize in all of this. Be careful. Okay, last one, the accusative. A noun may be used in such a way to limit an assertion, which function we describe as the accusative case. Now, he gives limitation then as the root idea. And this can be a little confusing because a person could easily say that genitive and dative also limit. The genitive will, you could talk about a kingdom, for example. He'll give an example later on. And kingdom is a pretty general term, but if you say kingdom of Herod, now you've got a limitation of the concept of kingdom. And genitive also can be defined in terms of limitation, but it's a slightly different kind of limitation, and we'll see that a little bit later on. Accusative's got more of a limitation in terms of extent rather than in terms of kind, like the genitive does. So limitation of extent, limitation of... Well, I'll leave it for a more detailed study a little bit later on here. Limitation is all right, but you have to kind of see the sense in which there's limitation, because the others can all be described that way too in a certain sense. Okay, these eight functions define the root idea of the eight cases. For the eight cases, we ordinarily find only four inflectional endings, with occasionally a separate form for the vocative. The matter may be graphically represented thus. So you have that graph there, and I think, like I said, it's worthy of taking note of and keeping in your mind what these basic functions are. Okay, now with that, I'm not going to read through a lot of the small print here, but you can when you have opportunities, giving some fine points. And a lot of the small print is describing what different scholars and their opinions and so forth and what he thinks of them and so forth. Going to page 68 at the bottom here, the nominative case, we'll look at that one now first in detail. And so now we're going to be looking into detail in each one of these case functions, looking at examples and so forth. And remember now that these analyses that we're seeing are not something that's necessarily given by inspiration of God. And like I said, we can designate separate case forms, but these subcategories and so forth is just a matter of grammarians looking at how things are used, trying to see patterns in the way that they're used, and then putting labels on those various patterns just for learning purposes primarily. So I think there's a reason, there's a place for these things, but we need to keep them separate from some sort of an absolute thing given from God. It's something that's given as a useful tool to help us analyze things. Okay, so section 83, taking up the treatment of the cases in the familiar order, we approach first the nominative first. That is not the first in the order of time. And of course, that gets into some questions as far as the origin of languages, too. The original function of the nominative was to lend more specific identification to the subject of a finite verb. In Greek, the verb expresses its own subject, as ekeruxa means he preached. Consequently, when we express a noun as a noun subject of the verb, it is in apposition with the subject implied in the verb itself. Thus, ho paulos ekeruxen literally really means he preached, that is, Paul. In other words, what he's getting at is the fact that the Greek verb contains the pronoun idea means that all you need is ekeruxen to get he preached. And then when you want to say Paul preached, the way that the Greek is doing it is he preached, that is Paul. In other words, now you're naming specifically the he that's already contained within the verb form. So that's why he gets the idea of apposition. He, Paul, preached. Okay? because you could take Paul out of there and still get he preached. In English, you wouldn't. If you take he out of there, you know, you just got preached, and you don't really have a concept. So, but Greek contains that within the inflectional endings of the verb form. So, in Greek, it's more of an appositional type of relationship. Therefore, the nominative is more than the case of the subject. It is the case of specific designation. So it's not just subject, because you can have a concept of a subject even without anything in the nominative, just by the verb form. So it's more designation, specific designation of the subject. That's what the nominative does, specifically designates it, and is in appositional relationship with that pronoun idea of the subject. Okay, that's just a kind of a fine point there. Now he breaks it down into several subcategories of nominatives here, about five subcategories, and there's some overlap between them and so forth. And sometimes you may find an example that, what I should say maybe here is that because we break these things down into categories does not necessarily mean that any example that you find will fall clearly into one of those categories. You may find an example in the New Testament. Into several of these categories, for example. It may be hard to decide which one it is. So, and you needn't be worried about that. The purpose of specifying these categories is just for learning and observational purposes, to help open our eyes to the way things are used. So the first category is the subject nominative. That's the most common one, of course. Though the nominative cannot be strictly defined as the case of the subject, yet its chief use is to specify that which produces the action or presents the state expressed by a finite verb. Since some verbs are action verbs, some verbs are stated verbs, we have to define it both ways. This is really the appositional use of the nominative, seeing 2 Corinthians 10:1 and so forth, and hence includes what is usually termed the nominative of apposition. Now here's an example here in John 3:35. Ho pater agapa ton huion. Simple subject, verb, object, sentence structure. The Father loves the Son. And ho pater is designating specifically. See, agapa ton huion would just mean he loves the Son. Now ton patera agapa ton huion is, of course, specifying specifically the subject of the action. That's the use that we're most commonly familiar with. Okay, now the predicate nominative we've also discussed. This is where you're using equative verbs. A further example of the appositional aspect of the nominative is seen its uses as predicate. Here, its significance of designation is strengthened by making it the thing emphatically defined by the sentence, as when we say, O keruson esti Paulos, the one preaching is Paul. Okay, esti, here's your equative verb, and Paulos would be a predicate nominative, and O keruson would be the subject. And so we're familiar with this predicate nominative construction, and we'll have nominatives on both sides of the equative verb. And again, the concept of designation, specific designation, and almost an emphatic designation when we see a predicate construction. Okay, example here again, humeskar este hedoxa hemon, for ye are our glory. All right, nominatives on both sides, humes, and then equated with hedoxa. So those we've already had, I think those are pretty straightforward. Now, the nominative of appellation, third one. Since the nominative is by nature the naming case, it is not strange that there should be a tendency to put proper names in this case, irrespective of contextual relations. So we often find a proper name in the nominative in such connection as to leave an awkward grammatical structure. Such instances yield to the genius of the case rather than the demands of the context. Okay, what he's saying is that you'll find occasionally in the New Testament proper names put in the nominative case, even when the context would expect maybe an accusative or something else. In other words, the context would show them to be in some particular case form, and then this happened to be in the nominative. And that may be the reason why some words and proper names of men and so forth don't decline hardly at all. You just use the nominative form for everything. And that may be due to this very factor. So here's one example. Engisen pros to oros to kalumenon elion. Now this elion is in the nominative case, all of it. And pros to oros pros is a preposition taking the accusative, and the whole rest of the construction is in the accusative, but elion is nominative. And so this is an example of what they're talking about. Since it's naming, and especially with this kalumenon, he mentions here this passive form of kaleo, something being called something, is almost always begging for a nominative. So that's what he's talking about. Now, there's something interesting he mentions here, too. This little note here, this use of the nominative is a possible explanation of the grammatical difficulty in Revelation 1:4. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not. I think, Eric, weren't you looking into that one? It talks about the one who was and is to come, the Almighty. It's got ho-on, ho-ein, and ho-erkomenos. Now, ho-on is no problem. Omega nu, that's just the participle, you know, for the present participle of eimi. And erkomenos is, you know, no problem at all. So it's from erkomai, is to come, and a passive participle because it's a deponent verb. But the trouble is ho-ein. Now, ein is just your imperfect form of the verb to be, finite form of the verb to be, third person singular form. And that's not something you normally put an article on. And, you know, and a lot of commentaries have difficulty with this, too. Just, you know, normally you'd expect a participle, you know, a past participle or something like that, if you wanted to say who was. What they're saying here is that this is probably a case in which this thing is functioning like a noun. They've taken this verb, put an article on it, made it function like a noun, and a proper noun, indeed. And with the article being nominative, you know, it's even though you don't have any ending on it, it's considered nominative. And he's saying that it's nominative because of this thing. It's a proper name. And the one who was, you know, I don't know how you would say it other than that in English. So that's a very interesting passage. So it's almost as though the revelation and the truth is overrided grammar there. The ho-ein, you know, the one who was. Because it's not really a participle form. So that's the grammatical difficulty he's talking about there. And to call this a nominative proper noun may be a way to look at it. Then he also mentions it's frequently seen with the passive of kaleo, something being called such and such. And regardless of what the preposition was before the kalumenon and so forth, you'll generally see the nominative case there. Okay. Was there a question, anybody, on that? All right. Now, fourthly, the independent nominative. When an idea is conceived independent of any particular verbal relations, the expression of it may be left standing alone in the nominative, with some descriptive or explanatory phrase added. Thus employed, the nominative names an idea rather than an object. This includes what is sometimes called the parenthetic nominative and the nominative absolute. Okay, what the basic distinction here is, you see something in the nominative, maybe a phrase in the nominative, you know, with the nominative being the predominant thing in the phrase, and it's just standing by itself without any verb connected to it or anything else, just kind of a statement a person's making. And what it does is it draws your attention, your concept, in a certain direction, but it doesn't give any verbal action and so forth associated with it. Look at the example here. Tauta ha theorete elusontai himerai. These things which ye see, the days shall come. In other words, he says, these things which ye see, and then he just kind of drops that whole thing, and then says, the day shall come when such and such, and goes on with another sentence. These things which ye see, well, what about them? You know? But what's happening is that he's just kind of encapsulating that whole concept, and he's just saying, you know, it's as though you're saying this, I want to call your attention to these things which ye see. Put your attention on those. Now you got your attention on those things, now he goes on to make another statement. So it's almost just drawing your consciousness to this and just laying it out in front of you and just causing you to pause and consider it and then going on with the statement. And it may seem a little awkward, but the way that the construction is done in such an abrupt fashion like this, just throwing this out, is done purposely to draw your attention. It's more graphic, it's more emotion to it, you might say, to do it this way. And you'll see this in salutations a lot. The nominative as used in salutations is an example of this case. 1 Corinthians 1:1, I think it says something, Paul, an apostle, you know, called God, or whatever. And to the churches in such and such, to the church in Corinth, whatever. Now, there's no verb in there. It just says Paul, such and such, such and such, in the nominative, to the church,
Paul what to the church?
You know, is he writing or what? Yeah, well, the obvious idea is that he is writing, but he doesn't state it that way, and he just kind of puts the thing out as the label to the whole thing. And so if you tried to diagram that, you'd be in real rough shape. You know, you kind of have to put a understood verb or something in there. But this would be what we call an independent nominative. We also find the independent nominative is used as a sort of nominative absolute in proverbial expressions and quotations. He gives an example, 2 Peter 2:22. That's the one where it talks about the dog going back to his vomit and so forth. And the way the construction is there, in English we translate in such a way that we've got a verb, you know, subject, verb, object construction. But in the Greek has just got a participle there. You know, a dog having returned to his vomit and so forth. And it doesn't make any sense to say dog having returned to his vomit, but we almost have to translate it, the dog has returned to his vomit and so forth, in order to get the idea. But just all put in the nominative. Just dog in the nominative with a participle in the nominative and so forth, and just kind of labeling that concept. And then this 1 Corinthians 3:19, what was that one? I just looked it up. It's a similar type of expression. Yes, that's the one. He's talking about the wise versus the foolish and so forth, and it says something about as it is said in the Proverbs, or as the Proverb says, and so forth. He takes the foolish and the wisdom, whatever. And it's the same kind of thing. There's just a participial construction, and there's no finite verb involved, even though in English we're translating it with a finite verb. Okay? There's a certain feeling that you get from that, though, as you're reading it. It just kind of throws that concept out. It's just calling your attention to this concept. Very, very interesting. Okay, and then this last one, the nominative of... Let's see, I don't think our clock's working at all there. Okay, good. Yeah, I didn't think the hour would go quite that fast. All right, we've got about 10 minutes left then. The nominative of exclamation. When it is desired... So this one might be considered in some books the same as the previous one, except there's more emotion to it. You'll see what I see in saying here. When it is desired to stress a thought with great distinctness, the nominative is used without a verb. The function of designation, serving ordinarily as a helper to the verb, thus stands alone and thereby receives greater emphasis. It is as when a child, in joyous surprise, points his finger at a friend who approaches with fruit and cries, "Apples." It would quite obviously weaken the expression to say, "There are apples." The nominative is the pointing case, and the pointer and its pointer capacity is strengthened when unencumbered by a verb. You see that? There's an emotional expression that's coming by taking the verb out. Instead of saying "there are apples," it says "apples," you know, and just no verb at all, just a simple expression of a word. And in Greek, this would be in the nominative case, and this would be what's called a nominative of exclamation. When you're emphatically drawing your attention to a concept and wanting not to burden the thing down with verbal ideas or anything else. Here's an example, of course, in Romans 7:24. "Wretched man that I am," you see. And there's a verbal idea there, of course, but in English. But in Greek, it's just wretched, the adjective wretched, ego, and anthropos, you know. So wretched man that I am, just wretched man, you know, that's all you got there in Greek. And it's just, it's all in the nominative, and it's just laid right out there. And there's no verbal action there. You're not just saying, "I, as a wretched man, have done such and such." You just said, "Wretched man that I am." It's very, very graphic, very powerful, very expressive, because it's not being covered by a verb. And because of the, you're looking for a structure, subject, verb, object, and so forth. And you see this thing break that all up and just draw your attention to that, it really gives an emotional and emphatic impact. And if you saw this in Rotherham, I'm sure he'd have some big marks around both sides, you know, and strong emphasis. Okay, so there's the nominative case. There's five subcategories for it, and like I said, there can be some overlap. A person could consider this exclamation as a subcategory of the independent nominative. It's the same kind of thing, except there's maybe a little bit more emotion behind the latter one. And that's going to have to be cited by context and things. Okay, the vocative case, we've already looked at that, and there's not too much said about this, because it's pretty specific. Its use is very specific, that of an address. So the vocative has but a single use, and that is the case of a direct address, if indeed the vocative may be properly called a case. When the address is intended to carry special force, the inflectional particle O is used, as in Matthew 15:28. And so Greek is the same thing as English. O Agrippa, or O so forth, and they just use the word O as well as we do. Otherwise, the simple vocative is used in, as in Acts 17:22 when it's desired to describe to the object of address special definiteness. The article is used, and we'll get into that some more later with the article. And since it is necessary to use the nominative form of the article, there being no distinct vocative form, this influences the use of the nominative ending for the noun, but the vocative function is there just the same. We've seen that there are some words that have a separate vocative form, but most of the words just use the nominative form. That's the point he's getting at there. Okay, so example here, Tharse Thugater, be a good cheer, daughter. Direct address. Nothing much to say about that. I think it's all pretty straightforward. There's not much controversy about that one. Now the genitive case. That's one where we have to take some time. First section 85. The genitive is a case of definition or description. It is in function adjectival. And we've already seen some parallels between the concept of an adjective modifying a noun and taking another noun and putting it in the genitive to modify a noun. And in some cases, there's even overlaps in translations of those things. Sometimes you can translate a genitive phrase by an adjective in English and vice versa. Although I don't think it's always the wisest thing to do, and you can lose something by doing that. So its function is adjectival, usually limits the substantive or substantival construction. Substantive would be a noun or a participle or something that's acting like a noun, or an adjective that's acting like a noun, or a substantival construction. We haven't dealt with that too much except for participial phrases. Whole participial phrase can be dealt with this way. But we will see later on that even a whole entire sentence can be a substantival construction. And a whole sentence can be treated as if it were a noun, and then a genitive phrase applied to it or something like that. So that'll be very interesting. When we look at the article, we'll see how the article functions to designate some of those things too. Anyway, though its use is not infrequent with verbs, adjectives, and adverbs, its adjectival nature is very pronounced and quite obvious. To say a flower beauty is not very different from saying a beautiful flower. So, cardia, apistias, a heart of unbelief, is practically the same in sense as apistos cardia. Apistos cardia, an unbelieving heart. Now, the first one, cardia apistias, a heart of unbelief, is taking the noun apistia and putting it in the genitive case and using it to modify heart. The other instance, apistos, is just using an adjective to modify cardia. And you get the same general idea, although, like I say, there is a distinction in force. Notice he mentions here, but the qualifying force of the genitive is more emphatic than that of the adjective. And I think that's really a good observation. When you use something in the genitive, it's more emphatic. It's got, I think we saw an example before about a disobedient son or a son of disobedience. Son of disobedience carries more weight, carries more power than just saying a disobedient son. It seems to be characterizing him more thoroughly by this attribute, and I think it's a safe distinction. Okay. He goes on with some other examples and so forth there, but let's move up to section 86. It says, there is a marked penetration in the statement of Gessner-Harrison that the genitive is employed to qualify the meaning of a preceding noun and to show in what more definite sense it is to be taken. Okay, that's the basic idea. It's going to be qualifying the meaning of a previous noun or preceding noun and showing what more definite sense is to be taken. Thus, it's the basal function of the genitive is to define. And this, it quite clearly carries with it the idea of limitation, and thus to show kinship with shows kinship with the accusative, which also has the idea of limitation. That's the point I brought up before. Both of these are dealing with limitation, but they're different kinds of limitation. The genitive limits as to kind, while the accusative limits as to extent. Okay, let's look at he gives a couple examples here to help illustrate this. And that's something to keep in mind as we get into our translations and so forth. And we've seen a lot of expressions in the chapters in Getches where it dealt with alternate uses or other uses of the cases, they listed a number of examples of time relationships and so forth, where we had a bunch of them with dative, a bunch of them with genitive, a bunch of them with accusative. Some of them seem to be almost the same, but they use different cases. Well, there is a distinction. Here, ergesa to tein hemeron means he worked through a portion or throughout the day. That's with the accusative. While ergesa to teis hemeras means he worked in daytime and not in nighttime. See the distinction? Both of them, similar expressions. One using accusative, one using genitive. The one that's using genitive is talking about the kind of work he's doing. It's daytime kind of work. He worked in the daytime as opposed to nighttime, that kind of work, in that kind of a realm. Whereas the other one, he worked the day throughout the, you know, he worked, it's setting limits of extent. The extent of his work was during the day. And that's the idea. He worked throughout the day or worked through a portion of the day. And, you know, it, in a loose translation, you might just render them both the same. He's working in the daytime, you know. But one of them's got the emphasis upon the duration of it and a portion of the day that he's working in. The other is talking more about the kind and the distinction in kind. Some of those things will be very hard to express in translations. So that's why we're trying to take the time now to go deeper and try to understand it, even if it's hard to express. We may be able to have to word it something like this and just in exegesis be able to explain. This is a genitive, not an accusative. This has got this emphasis as opposed to the accusative and so forth. Sometimes in order to illustrate those distinctions, you might say you're doing a theological paper and the thing happened to be in the genitive, for example, but it could have been in the accusative, and you want to make an emphasis on that point. You might say, if it were in the accusative, this is the idea it would have. But it's in the genitive, so it's got this idea. And show the contrast there that will help the person see what you're getting at. Okay, the genitive reduces the range of reference possible to a reference possible to an idea and confines its application within specific limits. So anytime you put a genitive phrase on a thing, you're reducing the whole scope of the thing and making it more specific. Thus, basileia denotes an idea of a wide variety of possible meanings. Kingdoms are of many kinds when we consider both the literal and the metaphorical use of the term. But he basileia theou denotes but a single kingdom and a particular kind of kingdom of God. Thus, by the use of the genitive, the implications of an idea are brought within a definite scope. Okay. This last part here. Well, there's a thought I want to glean from this section. I don't know if I want to read through the whole thing here. Let's just pick it up from the very last couple words in this page and then the top next page. Thus, basileia requires a certain nature on the part of its limiting genitive. It must express an idea which may be consistently associated with the thought of a realm of organized and regulated activity. It's maybe getting a little bit philosophical here, but what he's getting at, the bottom line is that when you use a genitive phrase, there's got to be some sort of a rational and reasonable association between the two. In other words, if you want to make any sense, you need to use genitive modifiers and nouns that would appropriately fit conceptually. So it says, hence it is because of God's essential sovereignty that we may construct the phrase, hey basileia theou, because of the fact that God is a king, God is a monarch, and therefore it's appropriate to use the term kingdom of God, because he is a king. You know, and if you talk about the kingdom of a snail or something, it's not very appropriate, you see. In other words, it's got to be something that fits. The genitive theou ascribes to basileia a rational attribute. So the use of the genitive is to describe a rational attribute to the idea defined. To denote by the genitive that which is not a rational attribute results in absurdity, as the humidity of the desert or the heat of the ice. You see, now, in a certain physical, from a physicist standpoint, you can talk about the heat of ice, but from a normal everyday linguistic sense, you don't. Okay. Yeah, if you're used to absolute zero, minus 273 degrees Kelvin, or 0 degrees Kelvin, minus 273 Fahrenheit or something, then ice is 32 degrees. You know, Fahrenheit seems very warm. But in normal language, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. So, or hey basileia doulou, the kingdom of the slave, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So the genitive qualifies a noun by the attribution of some essential rational relation or characteristic. That leads into another distinction, the idea of relations versus characteristics, and then tomorrow we'll go through the various subcategories of the genitive. And feel free to read ahead and get familiar with some of these things so that you can ask more specific questions as we go. And we'll continue with that tomorrow.